This presentation is brought to you by iawaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
He was telling me how excited he was on one occasion that he had the opportunity of getting in to speak to Rav Moshe Feinstein. And I asked him, what did you discuss? And he said, well, he didn't know quite what to discuss, so he asked him a question. That's not a bad thing to do with Rav Moshe Feinstein. He was rather an expert at that kind of thing. What was the question? This particular person was had terrible sorrows during the war. He went through the concentration camps and he lost his family. He always felt very bitter about it. And he asked Rav Moshe why we don't have some special day to remember the Holocaust in the same way, and other Jewish tragedies, in the same way as we have a Tisha B'Av. That's what he asked. Of course, you know, there is this Yom HaZikaron that they have, but that's not a religious innovation. It wasn't instituted as a religious innovation, and it's not observed as any kind of a religious day. It's a sort of a national memorial day, but it's not. It has very little religious significance to it. And the Chachorim, the Gedolim, were never misakim. They never legislated a day of mourning, other than the fast that we have already and the periods of mourning that we have. And Rav Moshe answered the well-known answer that Tisha B'Av covers all of them. Tisha B'Av is a day not only that commemorates the destruction of the Beis Hamikdash, but on Tisha B'Av we also commemorate all of Jewish tragedy throughout the ages. That wasn't the greatness of the answer. The greatness was the continuation. And Moshe said to this Yid, and why is that? Why is Tisha B'Av used as the day that's in commemoration of all tragedies? We don't have one day that's for Purim and for Hanukkah and for Pesach and Shavuot. Each time has its own day. Why should Tisha B'Av be used as the day to commemorate all of Jewish tragedy? So he answered, because Tisha B'Av was the cause of all Jewish tragedy. The Churban Beis Hamikdash was the beginning of it all. And everything tragic which has happened to the Jewish people subsequently has its roots in Tisha B'Av, in the destruction of the Beis Hamikdash. Had that not occurred, all the other tragedies wouldn't have happened either. So in effect, by the Avelus, by the mourning that we practice on Tisha B'Av, we are in fact relating to the root cause of Jewish tragedy, and the understanding that Jewish tragedy has its root causes in the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, in the Churban HaBayis, and not in anything else. It's not caused politically, and it's not caused historically. It's caused by one thing only. Ultimately, it's a chain reaction of events whose origin is the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. It's a wonderful understanding of the relevance and significance of parts of the relevance and significance of a Tisha B'Av today. And that I heard from the Prophet Yid sitting over a very makeshift Shabbos meal in a hotel room in Hong Kong. Sometimes one has to go to funny places to hear some fine pieces of Torah. But that means that we're never going to solve the problems of Jewish tragedy and put an end to them unless we get to the bottom of the causes of the Churban, of the destruction, and then attempt to rectify them. And Tisha B'Av isn't the commemoration of an event. We've discussed so often that there's nothing in Yiddishkeit which isn't merely the commemoration of an event. We don't live in the past, we live in the present. And if we have a Tisha B'Av, it's because there's a certain avodah, there's a certain effort and working on oneself that has to take place in the Tisha B'Av period. More than that, there's a Yerushalmi in the beginning of Tehillim that says that any generation in which the Beis HaMikdash is not rebuilt, it's as if that generation, ki'ilu hecheriboy, it's as if that generation destroyed the Beis HaMikdash. So it's all very well looking back piously at the earlier generations and figuring out what did they do so terrible that destroyed the Beis HaMikdash. If we look at the destruction in that light, we're already off on the wrong tack. They did nothing more or nothing worse than we're doing. Because if we were one little millimeter better than them, the Beis HaMikdash would be rebuilt. So whatever they did, we're doing at least as much. So the emphasis of our analysis has to be not what did they do that caused the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, but what are we doing that has caused the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. Whatever went wrong is still wrong. For if it went wrong, the Beis HaMikdash would have been rebuilt. There's a Gemara in Yuma that says that the first Beis HaMikdash was destroyed because of Gilui Arayah, Shvichus Damim, and Avodah Zarah. Immorality, idolatry, and idol worship. It's doubtful that Gemara means gross Avodah Zarah and gross Gilui Arayah and gross Shvichus Damim. But there were touches of it, enough to make the Ribbono Shel Olam not desire the Beis HaMikdash to be retained. And there's a Gemara Nedarim that asks the question in Pei Aleph Amud Aleph, when Yirmiyahu HaNavi asks, Miho ish hechorchom beyovin ezoz, who is the wise person who can understand this question? Why was it destroyed? What Yirmiyahu is dealing with is not so much the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, but the destruction of the whole of that society, including Eretz Yisrael. Al mo ovdo ha'oretz, asks Yirmiyahu, why was the land lost? Why did we lose Eretz Yisrael? And that doesn't just mean Eretz Yisrael politically and geographically. That means Eretz Yisrael with everything that was part of Eretz Yisrael with life at that time. Why did we lose it? Why was it taken away from us? Vayemir Hashem, and Yirmiyahu says, Hashem answered, Al ozvo mes toirosi, asher nosati lifneihem. For they have forsaken my Torah, which I gave them, v'lo shomu v'kili, v'lo holchuvo. And they didn't listen to my voice, and they have not walked in its way, the way of the Torah. But the Ribbono Shel Olam wasn't asked the question. Yirmiyahu says, the question was asked to Miha Isha Chochom V'yovin Esos. Who's the wise man that can understand this? Explains the Gemara. Dovazde Nishol Achachomim V'anvim V'loi Pishu. This question, why was the Beis HaMikdash destroyed, but why was that whole society destroyed? That was asked of the Chachomim, and it was asked of the Nevi'im, and nobody could explain it. Ad Shepirshu HaKadosh Baruch Hu Ba'atzma. Until the Ribbono Shel Olam himself explained, it says by Yom Hashem, and Hashem said, Al ozvo mes toirosi. Asks the Gemara, Haynelo yishomu v'koyli haynelo holchubo. What are these three different things? They left my Torah, which I gave them, and they didn't listen to my voice, and they have not gone in my ways. That's all saying the same thing, asks the Gemara. What does it mean? Al ozvo mes toirosi, they left my Torah. Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Rav, she'en mevorchim batoiro tchilo. They don't make the bracha on the Torah first. It's interesting, the grammar is interesting. He doesn't say Shaloi Birchu Batorah Tchilo. He doesn't say, for they didn't, in the past tense, they didn't make a bracha on the Torah. He says She'ein Mevorchim, they are not making a bracha on the Torah. It's put in the present tense. It's interesting. Ask the Ran. We learned this Ran previously on the Tisha B'Av Shir. Since it says, and Hashem answered that this has been done for you because you forsook my Torah, that shows that nobody could answer except the Ribbono Shel Olam. And then he brings a Rabbeinu Yonah who says that the Pasuk clearly means that it's the Brocha that was missing, not that they weren't learning Torah. That can't be. Because, says Rabbeinu Yonah, if they weren't learning Torah, why was it such a difficult question to answer? Nobody was learning Torah when everybody said, why was the land destroyed? The answer is simple. No Torah, there are no yeshivas, there are no Bosem Midrashim, nobody's learning. That's why the land was taken away. What do we have Eretz Israel for? We have it for Torah. We have it for learning. That's what we have Eretz Israel for. And if there's no learning, we're going to lose it. And that would have been an obvious answer, says Rabbeinu Yonah, so you can see they were learning. That's why it was such a terrible question. What's going wrong?
There are yeshivas all over the place. There are Rosh yeshivas all over the place. There are shiurim, there are basic midrashas and basic knesses. There are people learning and learning and learning. Chadorim, schools. Everything you could want is happening in terms of Torah. So why did we lose the land? It must have been, says Rabbi Yehuda, something terribly subtle. What is that, says the Gemara? Sure they were learning, but they didn't used to make the bracha for Torah that we make every morning. That bracha they didn't used to make. That's why they lost the land. Don't forget, this was at a time when there was, on whatever level we want to explain it, but the fact is there was Gilei Arayos, Shvichas Domim, and Avodah Zarah. We know that at that very time there was immorality and idolatry and murder in one form or another, as I said, on whatever level you want to take it, but it took place, there was that going on. But that's not why the Ribbono Shel Olam expelled them from the land. That's not why they lost Eretz Yisrael. They lost Eretz Yisrael because they didn't make the bracha on the Torah, which we have to understand still. One thing is for certain. Let's clarify that already at this point. Why then didn't they realize that that was the problem? They've looked in the Siddur, seen that there's a big kasatur in the Siddur, and they're not saying it. If that's the only thing they're doing wrong, surely they could figure that out. The Beis Halevi explains that there are two ways of looking at the learning of Torah. The one way of looking at it is as the acquisition of information needed to live like a Jew. In order to live like a Jew, we need to know certain things. And those things we learn from the Torah. And the other way of looking at the mitzvah of learning Torah is that it's a mitzvah in itself. Even if you're learning something that you know already, even if you're learning the information you have already, learning it in the Torah again and again and again remains a mitzvah. So you see clearly that the learning of Torah is not only the accumulation of information. And in fact, says the Beis Halevi, if it was merely the accumulation of information, there would be no chiyuv to learn at all. You could simply have a computer program that whenever you have a shaila, you ask the computer, what do? And it gives you the answer of what you do. It can be programmed by a big Talmud Chacham that considers every normal shaila that comes up in a person's daily life. And you simply put in, ask what you want, or you look up in an encyclopedia, or you look up in a Shulchan Aruch, and you see what you want to do. Or you ask somebody, you ask the Rav, what should I do? There should be no need for anybody to learn Torah if it's merely information gathering. Because then that information can be gotten from somebody else. You're not hired to research. You would have no obligation to research. You just need to know the conclusions. And we know that's not so. Every Jew has an obligation to research in Torah. And therefore the mitzvah of Torah is not only the accumulation of information, but it is also a mitzvah within itself. And the Beis Halevi says that you only make a bracha when the action you're doing is the end action. When what you're doing is merely the means of some later action, then you don't make a bracha on the earlier action. If your action is merely preparing for a mitzvah, you don't make a bracha. You make a bracha on the end action. Now, for example, we don't make a bracha on putting up the sukkah. Various reasons for it. That's one of the reasons. Put up a sukkah. It's a mitzvah to put up a sukkah. True. But the end of the mitzvah is sitting in the sukkah. So we make our bracha when you sit in the sukkah. Therefore, says the Beis Halevi, the criticism against that generation was that they were treating Torah as information needed to live like a Jew. But what's the end of the mitzvah? Using that information, not merely achieving that information. And therefore, they deliberately held that there should be no bracha made on this. This is only the preparation for the mitzvah. This is only part of the procedure of the mitzvah. This is not the end line of the mitzvah. And therefore, they didn't make a bracha. It's relatively easy to figure out what one is doing wrong when one is doing something wrong because of the Yetzer Hara. You know that you're not supposed to do it, but you've got a Yetzer Hara, so you do it. It's not so difficult to know that you've done wrong. But where you do wrong, b'shita, where you've worked out that this is the right thing to do, it's just that your approach is wrong, then it's very difficult to know that you're off the tracks. And that could be why this question they couldn't answer themselves, because they held, according to the way they understood Torah, that they couldn't figure out what they were doing wrong. Yet the Ribbono Shel Olam tells us that was what was wrong. And we'll discuss why it was so serious. But interestingly enough is the fact that for whatever reason, the Avera which caused the destruction of Eretz Yisrael was so subtle that no one of that or any subsequent generation could put their finger on it. Asks Reb Leib Chassman, in that case, why were they punished for it? How can you be punished for something that nobody can even notice what's wrong? The biggest Chachomim, the Nevi'im, were asked. And nobody, for whatever reason, we've explained one reason why it was virtually impossible for them to put their fingers on it. Whatever the reason, it makes no difference. We see that they were involved in something wrong, but so subtly wrong that nobody knew it was wrong. Not in that generation and not subsequently. And they analyzed it and they questioned it and they searched for it. They sought to try and find out, where have we gone wrong? And nobody could find out until the Ribbono Shel Olam came and said himself, Al Ozvam Es Torasi, because they haven't been making a bracha for their learning. That's what's wrong. But until the Ribbono Shel Olam himself revealed it, nobody could figure it out. How can you be punished for something you can't figure out is wrong?
The Blade Chasm asks. And he answers, you see from here, that the human being has an innate ability to know when he's doing something wrong. That you can have a situation where no expert would know that he's doing wrong. No psychologist would know that he's doing wrong. No psychiatrist would know that he's doing wrong. No Talmud Chacham would know that he's doing wrong. It's so subtle. No Novi would even know that he's doing wrong. But he can know that he's doing wrong. The human being has such a finely tuned conscience that if he's operating correctly, the red light starts flashing the moment he moves off center. And it is possible for a sensitive human being, and he is expected to, know the moment he is deviated from Emeskite. That he needs to know. And in fact, Reb Leib Chassman goes through a long discussion that that's the most critical part of tshuva. What we're punished for mostly is not knowing we did wrong. That's the worst part of it. Because, says Reb Leib, once a person knows that he's done wrong, he's already on the way to tshuva. But apart from that, he begins to suffer. Nobody likes to live in the knowledge that they've done wrong. The only way we can live with ourselves, one of two ways, we've either got to do tshuva, we've either got to repair the wrong, or we've got to persuade ourselves it wasn't in fact wrong. And that's why you see people twisting and turning and distorting themselves, trying to satisfy themselves that what they did wasn't really wrong. It's so impossible to live with oneself, if one's an honest, straight human being with a conscience. It's so impossible to live with oneself in the knowledge that one has done wrong, that we either have to do tshuva, or we have to persuade ourselves that it in fact wasn't wrong. And if we accept that it was wrong, then the suffering that a sensitive person goes through is already 9/10 of his ownish. That's already 9/10 of his punishment. Because, says Reb Leib Chassman, part of the reason for punishment is to bring us to the realization that we have sinned, so the tshuva should start. But if a person reaches that realization himself, he removes a great deal of the need for punishment. He's punishing himself. He's inflicting enough punishment on himself, having to go through this knowledge and this understanding of the chet which he's performed. That explains a lot of things. This little piece of Tanakh which we're about to get to in the later issue, where there's an army general under the king of Aram called Naaman. And Naaman became a metzora, he became a leper. And Elisha got a message to him that he could heal him. Yovei no Eli, let him come to me, v'yedak yesh novi v'yisroel. Not because I'm interested in healing that Rosho, that's not what I'm interested in. But I'm interested that Yedok Yesh Novi be Yisrael, let him know that there is a Novi in Yisrael. And if he'll come and be healed by the Novi, he will know that there's a Novi be Yisrael. And the story goes that Naaman comes and the encounter between him and Elisha, and eventually Naaman wants to pay for the treatment. He gets cured, and he wants to pay for the treatment.
And Elisha says, out of the question. He won't do it at all. He won't take any payment at all. He says, Kachno brocha meis avdecha. Take a brocha, take a gift from your servant. That's why, by the way, in South Africa they call, after Shabbos, after the davening, when they have a kiddush, which in overseas they call it a kiddush. Here they call it a brocha. They used to, before we got invaded by people from other countries, it used to be called a brocha. You know, they started calling it a kiddush also earlier. They used to call it a brocha. And nobody could understand why call it a brocha? What's a brocha? We see that there's a mekorot. When you give a gift, this is a mincha, Rashi says, this brocha, mincha sholim, it's a gift of sholim. When one gives someone something to eat as a gift, the Tanakh calls it a brocha, so there's a mekorot for it. And Elisha says, no. Chai Hashem asher amadati lefon avim ekach. Absolutely not. I swear by Hashem that I will not take anything from you for this. Off he goes. Elisha has a shamas. The financial administrator of Elisha's yeshiva was a man called Gehazi. And Gehazi is upset with this. He can't see the opportunity going. The wealthy man's come to visit the yeshiva. He's impressed with Elisha to no end. He's been cured of leprosy. He would be a man who Gehazi knows would be willing to pay millions to be cured of the leprosy. He's been cured by the Rosh Hashiva. He's got his head in the sky. He's offered money for it. He says, no, thank you. I wonder, but says Gehazi to himself, it's my responsibility to make sure that the salaries are paid at the end of the month. So this is not going to happen. And he gets on his horse and he runs after Naaman. And he says to him, Shalom Adrini. She says, Shalom Adrini Shalochani Lema. My master sent me to say that two new young men have come to join the yeshiva. So we just sort of, you know, to explain why when you were there a few minutes ago, I didn't want the money because my budget was covered. The two new Kolalites have come. I've got to support new people since you left. So if you want to make a donation, we'll gladly accept it. He says to Naaman. And Naaman gives him quite a lot. And Gehazi knows that Elisha is not going to be too pleased with this. So he puts it away, deposits it in the bank quietly, and he leaves it there for a rainy day. And Elisha, when Gehazi comes back, Elisha says, Me'ayin Gehazi, where's Gehazi been? I haven't been anywhere. And Elisha says to him, I'm not stupid. I know that you've taken a gift from Naaman. And basically Elisha says to him, is the sacrifice of the Kiddush Hashem worth the few bars of gold? It was such a Kiddush Hashem. And he felt so indebted to Yisroel and to the Ribbono Shel Olam and to the Novi. He felt so indebted, it was going to change his life. He accepted monotheism, he was going to go back and practice it. And now you've gone and commercialized it? Do you realize what you've lost for a couple of bars of gold? And as a result of that, he says, the leprosy of Naaman will cleave to you and to your children forever. It's the curse that he gives Gehazi. The Midrash says that one of the things Torah comes from, we see from here, is, Gemara says, one of the things we see from here is that Torah comes for false shvuas, for false promises. Gehazi undertook with a promise that he wasn't going to, that he hadn't gone anywhere, and he had gone. But it's clear that it's more than that, because Elisha doesn't say that Torah tidbach b'cho, you will be struck with tzaraas. It says the tzaraas Naaman tidbach b'cho. That tzaraas, of that very same tzaraas, you're going to be infected by his tzaraas. Not just because you made a shua, because of the particular circumstances of the shua. So what is he being punished for? Is he being punished for taking money from Naaman? The Medrash says he's being punished for the false promise. If he's being punished for the false promise, why does he get the tzaraas of Naaman? He should just get tzaraas, full stop. Why is he infected by Naaman's tzaraas? What's the middle connected middle? But what we see is that what he is afflicted, the reason for which he is afflicted is the denial of having taken money from Naaman. Had he said, yes, you know, I did take money, this is the reason I did it, and it might have been wrong, I thought I had a good reason, you might disagree with me, if it's wrong, I'm sorry, I'll go and return it. He wouldn't have had saras. That's what the Midrash tells us. Had he not denied the Aveiro, it wouldn't have happened. It's true he's being punished for taking money, but he's really being punished for denying having taken the money from Naaman. And therefore he gets Naaman's disease. Because Mephoshim explained, Naaman is basically traded now. He sold his disease. He paid for it. He redeemed it. And someone has to take it. As long as you would have left it as it was a different kind of transaction. But now that money is exchanged, money has passed hands, something else has to pass hands to cancel it all out. And that's the tzoras. The punishment is for the denial. You find that, in a sense, this goes on all the time. The proportions have to be kept right. In America, the president is in trouble. What's he in trouble for? Not for helping out the Contras of Nicaragua. He's in trouble for claiming he didn't know about it. For denying it. That's the trouble, is it? And if you look at these various situations that have arisen in recent years, it happened to him, it happened to Nixon, it happened to Forster here. It's constantly happening to leadership. The inability to say, I did it, this is what I did, this is why I did it, and you happen to have elected me to use my sefer, which I used. If you disagree with me, let's discuss the issue. But once the person starts denying, then there's nothing to start with. There's nothing one can really handle. You're probably aware that Jack Abramoff was visiting here again. And we were talking about this concept. And he said, yes, you remember Gary Hart had to pull out of the presidential nomination. He said, not because he committed adultery. Nobody had that tiny against him, because he denied it. And he said, Bahariah, the proof is that there was another man, I've forgotten his name, who was standing for Senate election. And he learned a good lesson from Gary Hart. So before the newspaper started following him around, he got up and said, I'm a homosexual and I'm proud of it. Fine. Well, that's fine, good. If you want to get up and say, I murdered, that's also right. No, there are no tainas on that. Don't deny. That's where the concept's gone too far. That's where the integrity has become the only value. But that the integrity is an important link, in fact is the vital link, in the process of correcting a wrong, that's for sure. If there's integrity, we can correct our wrongs, we can correct our own wrongs, and we can correct one another's wrongs. If there's no integrity, there cannot be that correction. Ben Chasson, in fact, brings a pasuk from Yirmiyahu, which says it almost mefurush in Perek Beis. And he says, the Ribbono Shel Olam accuses Israel of doing terrible things. Vatimri, and you say, Ki nikesi na, I'm clean. Akshav apoy mimeni. Ribbono Shel Olam's anger should be removed from me. I'm clean. Says Yirmiyahu, Hineni nishpot oisoch al omrech loichotosi. I'm going to judge you not for what you did. I'm going to judge you for saying I didn't sin. That's the Aveiro. That's what you've done so terrible. So, Rebbe Chasson, why is that what you're being judged for? Surely you're being punished for the wrongdoing, not just for the denial? No! Because if there wouldn't be a denial, you would punish yourself. You wouldn't need my punishment. It would be sufficiently painful for you to live with the knowledge of the wrong that you've done. To have to face your conscience constantly, that would be the suffering. But as long as you deny that you did wrong, I've got to bring it to your attention, and I have to punish you for saying lo chotosi. That's the terrible thing. For saying lo chotosi comes the punishment. Therefore, says Rabbi Chasman, this ability that the human being has to be able to be responsible to himself for his own wrongdoing, to be able to put his finger on it, to know he's done wrong, is the essential component of the whole tshuva process. And it's that which saves a person from yisurim chas v'sholom, from punishment, from suffering, because the moment he has identified the wrongdoing, there's no reason for punishment anymore. There's no reason for punishment. And therefore he says the Churban Beis HaMikdash came for that very reason. Not just for what they did. They were doing worse things. There was Gilui Arayos. There was Shvichas Domim. There was Avodah Zarah. All the terrible Avodahs they were there. But that's not why the Churban came. The Churban came because they weren't able to identify their own wrongdoing. That's why it came. And now we need to try and understand why they weren't able to identify their own wrongdoing. And Medrash says, in the beginning of Eicha, also based on the Pasuk in Yirmiyahu, the Oisio Zobu says Yirmiyahu, there's Tehrosi Lo Yishomoru, they have left me, and they have not kept my Torah, as we learned. Says the Medrash, Medrash Rabbah, we find that the Ribbono Shel Olam was prepared, so to say, at times to turn a blind eye to Avodah Zarah, not to destroy the whole society because of Avodah Zarah, because of idolatry, Va'al Gilui Arayos, and immorality, Va'al Shvichus Domin. Of course, each individual is punished for what he does, but the Ribbono Shel Olam doesn't turn a blind eye to that, but not to destroy the whole society for those Avodahs. Ve'loi Viter Al Moso Shel Torah, that he was not prepared to turn a blind eye to the rejection of Torah. That not. Sheneh Maram of the Horitz, William Yehoshua says, why was this land destroyed? Alavirus Kechovim, Valgilu Arayis, Valshvichus Domim, Inksipkan. William Yehoshua doesn't go on to explain that the reason that the land was destroyed was for the Gilu Arayis and the Shvichus Domim and the Avodah Zarah, which we know was taking place. That's not the reason. Elal Ozvam Es Teirosi, but because they left my Torah. He goes on to explain, what does it mean? Two different things. They have left me and they have abandoned my Torah. If only they only left me, if only they only rejected me, the Ribbono Shel Olam, it would still have been alright, provided they kept the Torah. If they were dealing in Torah, if they were learning properly, the light of Torah would have brought them back to truth. As long as they're involved in Torah, everything else can be saved ultimately. But if they're not involved in Torah, there's no hope. So even if they had abandoned me, says the Ribbono Shel Olam, but at least the Torah they were involved with, Shuvah could have taken place. Now we begin to see a link. What are they blamed for? Says Reb Leib Chassman, they were blamed for not starting the Shuvah process. They were blamed for not taking the first step in tshuva. The first step in tshuva is an identification. Oi, I'm off center, I've gone off. That's the first step which has to be taken, and for that they were punished. And here the Midrash says that if they were learning Torah, they would have come to tshuva. So what do we see? That they were blamed for not learning Torah. For had they been learning Torah, they would have come to tshuva. That means it's accepted that they were doing other wrong things apart from learning Torah, because they needed tshuva. But had they been learning Torah, they would have done the tshuva. So at the final analysis, what they're being blamed for, the total destruction, comes when there's no hope. For as long as there's hope for tshuva, the Ribbono Shel Olam won't destroy the society. He'll punish the individual, but he won't destroy the society. He will only destroy the society when he sees that there's no chance of the society rectifying itself. Why is there no chance, says the Medrash? Because there's no Moir Shabbat, there's no light of Torah which can bring them to tshuva. That means the Medrash is telling us that there's only one thing which could have brought them to tshuva, and that they weren't doing. And what's the one thing, says the Medrash? Torah. But that's really difficult. Because we've just learned they were learning Torah, it's only a bracha they weren't making. They were learning Torah about Smodah Rabbah, they were learning day and night. That wasn't the objection. They are not claimed against for bittul Torah, for wasting time, only for not saying the bracha. And it was so subtle we learned that nobody realized it. So what does the Medrash mean? If only it was only me they had abandoned, says the Ribbono Shel Olam. If only they were still learning the Torah, they would have done tshuva, but they have been learning the Torah. So we have to say that the way they were learning the Torah was a way which couldn't bring them to tshuva. We see here very important to say that it's true that learning Torah affects the conduct of a human being. It's true that Torah may be all day zahirus. Clear? Because when Yoda says, if you've got Torah, everything else comes, step by step. The Torah makes you more conscious and aware. and the awareness gives you zrizus, gives you energy and vitality. And the energy and vitality brings you to nekius, and the nekius brings you to precious, and so you can reach the highest of high levels, provided this Torah. But here we see it depends what kind of Torah. In that generation there was Torah, enormous quantities of Torah. But lo yibirchu b'Torah tchilah, the only thing that was missing was the bracha. And the absence of the bracha meant that the Torah they were learning could not affect their conduct at all. But there was a barrier between the learning and the conduct. And when the Ribbono Shel Olam realized that, he realized that this can never come right. The society will never rectify itself because it will never recognize what it's done wrong. And now we can focus in a little bit further, and we can say, therefore, that Torah, if it's learned properly, with a bracha, we'll have to analyze that soon. If Torah is learned properly and related to properly, with a bracha, then that is the mechanism that the human being uses for that unique quality which Rav Leib Chassman referred to. That is the ability to notice the moment one's gone even slightly off course. If one is learning Torah properly, one has that ability to notice that one's off the line. What was missing in their Torah? They didn't make a bracha. So what? We've learned in our Gemara that the bracha for the mitzvah is separate from the mitzvah. If a person puts on tefillin and didn't make a bracha, he still got the full mitzvah of tefillin. He doesn't have the mitzvah of the bracha for tefillin, but he has the mitzvah of tefillin. If a person blows the shofar or hears the shofar and doesn't hear the bracha, he's got the full mitzvah of shofar. He hasn't got the mitzvah of the bracha. It's a different mitzvah. So why here does the bracha affect the mitzvah so adversely? That without the bracha you don't have the Torah properly, the Torah isn't affecting you correctly. It's not just that you didn't say the bracha, so you haven't got the mitzvah of the bracha. The mitzvah of your Torah is adversely affected because you don't have the mitzvah of the bracha. Had you been saying the bracha, the Torah would have brought you to tshuva, and now you cannot be brought to tshuva. And I think that the answer lies in the exact wording that Yirmiyahu uses more than one occasion. Al oz v'osi azov es toirosi loy shomoru. They have abandoned my Torah, says Yirmiyahu. And also in Perik Tes, Vayomer Hashem al oz v'om es toirosi Hashem nasati lifneihem. They have abandoned my Torah, which I have given them. Torah is a mitzvah for which one can develop almost, I'm going to use a funny word, but I think those of you who have learned nicely will know what I mean. You can almost develop a yetzer hara for it. It is so nice. It is so refreshing. It is so fulfilling, so mind stretching, so stimulating that it's literally that one can have a yetzer hara for it. And the proof that that is so is, in fact, that the great Chachomim of Yisrael experience great difficulty in stopping to learn at times and in places where they're not allowed to be learning. It's not easy. Comes a Tisha B'Av now, there are only certain things you can learn. A person who's really in learning finds that one of the most difficult things on Tisha B'Av. Not to learn, to stop. He doesn't feel alive. And why do I mean a yetzer hara? How can you have a yetzer hara for learning? Most people believe that as long as you're learning, it's fine, it's okay. As long as there's learning, everything's all right, everything's wonderful. A yetzer hara for something wonderful. But firstly, we see that's not so. The Gemara says several times that the Torah is samach chayim l'mayinim bo, samach moves l'masmilim bo, that the learning of Torah is a life potent for those who learn with their right hand, so to say, learn correctly and professionally, and it's Samhamovis, it's poison for people who learn amateurishly and lackadaisically and without the professional competence that one needs to learn with. Samhamovis, the Torah says, the Gemara says. Not that it's useless, it's destructive. So already we see, to say that you can have a yetzer hara for something, yes, it can be destructive if it's not handled correctly. And here too we see that they were learning Torah, plenty of it, but there was one dimension of the Torah missing, and that resulted in them being unable to see what was wrong with their entire society, and it resulted in Gilui Arayos and Shvichus Donim and Ritzicha, murder and idolatry and immorality, resulted from the fact that they weren't learning correctly. So we're playing with fire when we're talking about learning Torah. It's not a simple thing. What's the difference when one learns with a bracha and one learns without a bracha? Not getting into the question which we went into, why they were learning without a bracha. But one thing happens. The bracha is, Asher kiddushonu b'mitzvayisov, v'tzivonu la'asek b'divrei Torah. I praise the Ribbono shel Olam, who instructed me with a tzivui, a compulsion, to deal in Torah, to learn in Torah. That's what the bracha is. If I learn Torah with a bracha, then my motivation is primarily Tzivui Hashem. I'm learning because this is what God has instructed. It's true I enjoy it. It's true I love it. It's true I get tremendous fulfillment from it. But if you want to know why I'm learning, I'm constantly reminding myself that I'm learning because this is a Tzivui Hashem. The final analysis, this is the Ribbono shel Olam's Torah I'm learning. This is not just some skill that's been put together or some intellectual brilliant masterpiece that I'm studying. That's not what it is. This is the Tzivui Hashem. There's an instruction from the Ribbono shel Olam that every Jew, to the best of his ability, has to research the Torah. And that's what I'm doing. And there's no prohibition in enjoying it. On the contrary, that's part of the mitzvah of Lishmo. That's part of learning properly, is to enjoy it. When the Ribbono shel Olam says you must learn and research Torah, that means learn and research it with geschmack, with enjoyment and with fulfillment. Sure, there's nothing wrong with that. But it's something that one enjoys so much that one can have a yetzer hara to forget the link between the Torah and the Ribbono shel Olam. You know, there used to be a phenomenon in South Africa of the old Litvish Jews who came out here, and they gave up the Yiddishkeit slowly. They gave up their kashrus, they gave up their Shabbos, they gave up their Yom Kippur, but they didn't give up their learning. And so it was possible to walk into a person on Yom Kippur. We used to have a neighbor across the road from us that used to do that. He used to come in occasionally to discuss a kasha he was having his learning with my father. My father says it was a pleasure to talk to him. An absolute apikurus. It's a pleasure to talk in Gemara to him, a real lamdan. But he used to sit on Yom Kippur with a cigarette in his hand and tray for food in front of him, and he had his Gemara open, figuring out, scratching his head, working out the difficult Rambam, kashas, answers, backwards, forwards. And nobody can understand how such a thing. Such a thing as a yetzer hara for learning. That's the only mitzvah which, even if one disassociates it from the Ribbono shel Olam, that's for sure, retains a large portion of its exhilaration and its geschmack. If you take the Ribbono shel Olam away from Shabbos, Shabbos starts becoming meaningless. Good, okay, a day of rest, that's very nice, but that's not Shabbos. Not doing malachas, not getting in the car, not putting on lights. If you take the Ribbono shel Olam out of it, it becomes meaningless. It becomes an oil, it will become a burden. If you take the Ribbono shel Olam out of tefillin, it becomes an absurd action. If you take the Ribbono shel Olam out of sukkahs, it becomes ridiculous. But just as the winter's starting, you go into the outside, and it's ridiculous, it's absurd, uncomfortable. These things are only meaningful and only pleasurable because of their connection with the Ribbono shel Olam. But you can take the Ribbono shel Olam out of Torah kibyochel, and you're left with a brilliant system of legal and philosophic reasoning, the finest that there is in any civilization and has ever been, and you're left with material to study and enjoy, far more than mathematics, far more than literature, far more than philosophy. So it's possible to have a yetzer hara for learning. That means it's possible to become involved and retain an involvement in learning with a diminishing presence of the Ribbono shel Olam, with diminishing kedusha, with diminishing sanctity as one goes on. And that explains, people often ask, how can you have Talmidei Chachamim, how can you have people who are great in learning, whatever it is, and they're not great in any other area. We answer, you can even have people who are great in learning and they're Bechalei Shabbos. There doesn't have to be a connection. Once the Ribbono shel Olam is moved from the learning, then there doesn't have to be a connection at all between the learning and one's actions. But it goes further. If I'm learning not because it's a tzivui Hashem, I didn't say my brocha, Asher, Kiddushonu, B'mitzvayso, B'tzivon, and saying the brocha doesn't mean mumbling the brocha. Saying the brocha means learning with a consciousness of that brocha. If I don't say that, Asher, Kiddushonu, B'mitzvayso, B'tzivon, this is the Ribbono Hashem who is mekaveh me to learn Torah. If I don't say that, then I'm learning why? Because I have a tie for it, because I enjoy it. And the very act of learning is strengthening my tithes. It's strengthening my passions. And weakening my character. Every word I continue to learn weakens my ability to stand up against my passions and my desires. Because normally when we do mitzvahs, it's against our passions. Normally we would like to be doing other things. But it's tzivui Hashem, so we do it. And each thing we do, each bit of halacha that we meticulously follow, is another stage of victory over our passions and over our desires, where our minds and intellects are able to rule us. But when it comes to the Torah, which has its own Yetzirah, which satisfies its own passions irrespective of anything religious, then when I learn in that way, when I learn in order to satisfy my passions, then I'm in fact strengthening the passions and weakening the character. And when I do that, then there's no way that I'm going to come to recognitions of my wrongdoing. That's not going to be possible. When a person starts off saying, I'm learning because it's tzivui Hashem, that's why I'm learning. And then he sits down and he opens his Gemara. And he works and works and works and he sweats and he toils. And he suddenly gets so excited, he's got the most beautiful chiddush. He's able to explain a whole sugi of Gemara. He's able to explain a whole system in Rashi, and he's able to explain a whole shita in Tosfos. And all of a sudden the halacha clear, and he's on top of the world. The whole world is opened up to him. And his eyes are alight with excitement. And he's about to go and say it over to his chazusa, to his talmidim, or to his rabbein. And he comes across a chazal, another piece of Gemara, that destroys everything he was about to say. It's very nice, except he was missing one fact. It's all wrong. Now there are two kinds of people. The one person who's learning only for his desire will do everything he can to twist and to turn, to press and to shove, to make sure that his desires aren't disappointed. It's such a climax of pleasure. Is he going to allow that to disappear? And all his energies will go to trying to divert the little distraction which is causing a bit of bother to his pleasures. But if he's a person who said the bracha, Asher kiddushonu b'mitzvayso v'tzivonu, then his desire for learning is something else altogether. The Vilna Gaon that we didn't learn this morning, this afternoon, but we'll learn in Mirtzah Hashem next time, says in passing, the Hachachom, when the Chachom, the Talmid Chachom learns, Kavanosoi, his aim, his direction in his learning, he leido or emes, it's to know the truth in order to know from what he should be, for what he should avoid. That's what his emphasis is. His desire is to know the emes, because he realizes that if he doesn't know the emes, he's going to make a mess of his life. That he realizes. It's not sufficient to have the information. He wants more than that. He doesn't want to just know which way to go. He wants to understand which way to go. He wants to know why it has to be that way, because that's the emes. He wants to see things with clarity. And therefore, when he sees, after his hours and hours of sweat and toil and his exciting discovery, and he comes across one line of Gemara which destroys everything he says, Baruch Hashem. Goodness me, I nearly missed that. What a terrible thing it would have been had I missed that. And I would have built a whole building on something which is false. Where's the emes that I'm struggling to find? Baruch Hashem, Ribbono Shel Olam, that you revealed this to me just in time, that I'm able to destroy what I was about to say and to start again and to rebuild. A different approach. And one's learning with Asher Kiddushonu b'mitzvayso v'tzivonu, and one's learning with a tzivui Hashem, one's desire is to know the emes. That's the instruction. And one will do anything to get to the emes. And that's where the pleasure comes from clarity and from emes. But when one is learning without a brocha, then slowly, slowly, the learning becomes so enjoyable that one starts forgetting that there's a mitzvah. achieves its own dynamicism, it achieves its own motivation. And in fact, Yirmiyahu goes on in the very next pasuk and he says, "Vayelchu acharei sherirus libo," and they did just as they pleased. It so happens, one of the things they pleased was learning. That doesn't matter. They were learning because it was shrirus libom. They were learning because they wanted to learn. There was no tzivui Hashem in it. And the result of that is va'acharei ha'ba'olim asher limdu b'avisa. And the result of that is they land up going after Baal as well. They come on to Avodah Zarah as well. Because then there is no way of discerning anymore. There is no way of discriminating between that which is right and that which is wrong. Whatever I want becomes right. Which is not the case when a person is wrong. And that is emes. Is it true or isn't it true? And so to sum up, we've got the statement that the Beis HaMikdash, that the land was destroyed. Al Ozvo Mestirosi, for the forsaking of the Torah, Chazal tell us, does not mean they weren't learning, they were learning. It means only that they were not making a bracha. And although that was a very subtle fault, it was a fault which led to a destruction of their entire lives. And so the way we have to learn this Gemara in Adorim is really, we know why it was destroyed. It was destroyed because of Avodah Zarah and Gilui Arayos and Shfichus Domim. After all, that's the Gemara in Yuma and Daf Tes, that there was Gilui Arayos and Shfichus Domim and Avodah Zarah. We know they were terrible Avodahs at that time. What we want to know is, why didn't they do tshuva at any stage? Why didn't they realize that things were going wrong? To that the answer is, Al-Ozvam es Teirosi, because the only way you can know you're going wrong is if you're learning. Not just in terms of intellectual knowledge, but also in terms of being close to the source. For if you're going wrong, when you come and you sit down and you learn, you listen to a shir, or you open the Gemara and you immerse yourself in it, you feel immediately if you've come from a long way out, or if you've come from close by. And sits and learns, all of a sudden one realizes, where have I been? What have I been thinking? What have I been chasing after? This is where it's all at. It's an anchor. It keeps on bringing one back home. And when one's home, one's able to adjust one's values and to see things in the right light. But if one never comes home, then one never knows where one is. And then Yerushalayim says, Al-Ozvam es Teirosi, the reason they didn't know they were doing wrong is because they weren't learning. I would say they were learning. True, they were learning, but not with a bracha. What does it mean they were not learning with a bracha? If they're not learning, as the Medrash says, if only they were learning with a bracha, we now understand, then that would have been makdereis and lamutav. That would have brought them to tshuva. Because if one learns properly, understanding that this is a tzivui Hashem, one learns with emes, one learns with truth, and one becomes sensitive to any deviation from the truth. Fulfillment of the self-gratification. And as much learning as there was, and as much development as there was in the learning, there was no way that such learning could affect the conduct of the individual positively. There was no way that such learning could be maxirosam lamutov, that such learning would bring them to an understanding that they are doing wrong. If when one learns in that way, one can't even come to an understanding that one's learning is wrong, certainly one isn't going to come to an understanding that one's feelings are wrong, that one's actions are wrong, that one's philosophy is wrong. That's not possible. And as we started off saying, the Shalmi says in Peor, if any generation in which the Beis HaMikdash is not built is responsible for its destruction. And that's really where we're at. The ability has to be developed and cultivated of attaching ourselves mercilessly and ruthlessly to a search for emes, for the truth. Because when that's there, a great deal can be accomplished. There's been a lot of debate recently as to whether it's been right to drag these war criminals back into the courtrooms and to start, debate not amongst Jews obviously, and to start digging up the past and the whole story. Isn't that enough already? It's 40 years ago, over 40 years ago. It's enough already. And one of the claims is they've been living with their consciences all this time. They've been suffering already, you know, old men. The fact is, when they come into court, not one of them has said, Chotosi. Eichmann was standing on the gallows and was asked by his priest, by a priest, whether he wants to confess, whether he wants to do tshuva. He said, no, thank you. On the gallows. These people are standing in the courtrooms, not one of them have ever said, yes, I did it. These are the reasons I did it for. It was a terrible thing. It was wrong. I don't know how to pay for it. Unable to say that. So have they been living with their consciences? Where from? What conscience? Haven't been living with their conscience. And it's right to bring them back into the courtrooms if for no other reason than that we should remember that such a thing happened. Because just before these two criminals were caught, there was added momentum being achieved by the view, very actively being proposed all over the world, but particularly in Europe, that the Holocaust never happened. It was all Jewish propaganda. And it was becoming a very accepted, academically accepted view, with books written on it already, showing that it was very minor, there was nothing, no big deal that happened. These people were lost in war like anybody else was lost at war. And the whole ability to say chotosi is lost. And so it is with Eretz Yisrael. You know, there's a copy of the Kinnis, which we in fact have here in the Beis HaMedrash, in which there's an alternative Nachem to say on Tisha B'Av. You notice that one? Which does away with all the parts that talk about the destruction, or the present destruction. It makes Tisha B'Av into some commemoration of some past event, but now we've got Yerushalayim back, and now we've got Eretz Yisrael back, and so Tisha B'Av takes on a different light. It's a terrible thing, because that removes the very essence of Tisha B'Av. The moment we start believing that things are back, things are okay again. We've got Eretz Yisrael, we've got Yerushalayim, there's plenty of Torah, the yeshivas are full, everything's wonderful. The moment we start believing that, we become responsible again and again for the Churban. If that were true, the Beis HaMikdash would have been rebuilt. If the Beis HaMikdash has not been rebuilt, that means just what they were doing then, we are still doing now. That is, we're not learning with a bracha. We're not learning with emeskite. The learning is not affecting our conduct. The learning is not bringing us to teshuva. We're not attached to pure, unadulterated truth. And the result is we're unable to say chotosi, we're unable to look at ourselves and say this is still wrong, and that is still wrong, and we need to fix it, and we need to improve it, and we need to repair it. So the timing of Tisha B'Av, some 6 or 7 weeks before Rosh Hashanah, is in fact very significant. It almost is the beginning. Rather than Rosh Chodesh Elul, Tisha B'Av already should be viewed as the beginning of the tshuva process. Because in order to handle an Elul, you have to handle a Tisha B'Av first. We have to be able to face ourselves and understand that the first and most foremost element of any self-improvement is the ability to recognize, even in the most subtle areas, that we have gone wrong and where we have gone wrong. And then that knowledge in itself firstly relieves us of a great deal of punishment. The Ribbono Shel Olam looks at us in a different light. The moment the person says, "Oh, what's going on? I'm going off. I'm wasting my time. I'm wasting my energies. This isn't the right way." The moment he says that, the Ribbono Shel Olam already looks at him differently, removes a lot of punishment and yusurim from him, and the whole tshuva process begins and starts. A tshuva process which, if practiced by the whole of Klal Yisrael, will ultimately lead to the rebuilding of the Beis HaMikdash, to the reconstruction of Eretz Yisrael, and to the conversion of Tisha B'Av from a day of evil, from a day of mourning, into a day of simcha, into a day of rejoicing and of happiness.